people. They can't buy groceries anymore. They can't. You look at the cost of food, where it's doubled and tripled and quadrupled. They can't live. They're not living anymore. He caused this inflation. I gave him a country with no, essentially no inflation. It was perfect. It was so good. All he had to do is leave it alone. He destroyed it with his Green New scam and all of the other, all this money that's being thrown out the window. He caused inflation. As sure as you're sitting there, the fact is that his big kill on the black people is the millions of people that he's allowed to come in through the border. They're taking black jobs now, and it could be 18, it could be 19, and even 20 million people. They're taking black jobs, and they're taking Hispanic jobs, and you haven't seen it yet, but you're going to see something that's going to be the worst in our history.
Former President Trump and President Biden debating last night in Atlanta, Georgia, a CNN debate that was moderated by Jake Tapper and Dana Bash. We're joined by Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, author of Rigged: How Globalization Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. He's joining us from Astoria, Oregon. And joining us in our New York studio is Derek Hamilton, founding director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School, also a Henry Cohen professor of economics and urban policy. Welcome both to Democracy Now! Derek Hamilton, let's begin with you.
Well, clearly, Trump is a more effective messenger, but if we look at substance of policies, his policies are dramatically framed in a fascist notion of relative status, whether he's looking at black Americans versus white Americans or trying to message to black Americans. He presents a zero-sum scarcity framework, a threat of another group coming and taking your jobs, as opposed to an economy that flourishes, where there's plenty, where there's investments in our productive capacities, which obviously spills into democracy. On the other side, the bravado, the messaging of basically, here's what my administration, all these great things we did, that's problematic when people's lived experiences clearly aren't feeling that. A more effective message would be one where here are the trajectories and directions in which we're going. We are affirmatively thinking about race when we do our Inflation Reduction Act. We are affirmatively thinking about race when we consider cancellation of student loans, student loan debt. That would be a more effective message. And last thing I'll say really quick is, beyond either one of the candidates, how we got some of the interventions we got during the pandemic, like moratoriums on foreclosures, moratoriums on evictions, like sending checks directly to the American people, was through political movements, was through agitation. I want to be in a place where we're not reliant on any of these candidates, but we have momentum, we have paradigm change for a new economy that's productive and inclusive for all of us.
Dean Baker, if you can share your thoughts on last night's debate. I think the New York Times put the number of lies at several dozens by President Trump. What do you think was the message of Trump and Biden?
Yeah, well, the Biden message, unfortunately, is very muddled. I mean, he does have a lot to boast about. I mean, we did get the lowest unemployment rate we've seen in over 60 years. We've had, for blacks, black teens, the lowest unemployment rate ever recorded. Same for Hispanics. I mean, it's still way too high, but that's real progress. We saw good wage growth up and down the income ladder, and the strongest at the bottom. So workers at the bottom decile saw 12% real wage growth since the pandemic. This was really extraordinarily good. Also, really important point, the inflation was caused by the pandemic. You had inflation in Germany and France, roughly the same as the U.S. I know Donald Trump likes to say Biden's plan was awful, but pretty impressive if he brought about inflation all over the world with his plan. As far as what Trump did, maybe he doesn't know. When he left office, unemployment was around 6%, and jobs were not bouncing back. This is a really important point. We were creating 140,000 jobs a month his last 3 months. It takes us 5.5 years to have gotten back the jobs we lost with that rate of job growth. The other things he was saying, close to incoherent. he said them very confidently, but the greatest economy, again, the economy he had, you know, is a decent economy. It continued the growth rate that we saw under President Obama. So that's good. I mean, but it's hard to really boast about that when he was handed an economy that was growing well, the unemployment rate was coming down. So, yes, it was, to my view, very painful and really unfortunate that President Biden wasn't able to stand up and, you know, both take credit for what are really impressive accomplishments and point out that Trump was lying.
Saying, for example, that he'd created, Biden created, said 15,000 jobs rather than 15 million. He was his own worst enemy. I'm going to come back to the economy, but I want to go to the issue of reproductive rights right now and abortion. President Trump takes credit for the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, which returned the issue of abortion to the states. During last night's debate, moderator Dana Bash noted the federal government still regulates access to abortion pills, which are used in about two-thirds of all abortions. This was President Trump's response to whether he would block abortion medication if reelected.
And what I did is I put three great Supreme Court justices on the court, and they happened to vote in favor of killing Roe v. Wade and moving it back to the states. This is something that everybody wanted. Now, 10 years ago or so, they started talking about how many weeks and how many this, getting into other things. But every legal scholar throughout the world, the most respected, wanted it brought back to the states. I did that. Now the states are working it out. If you look at Ohio, it was a decision that was, it was a, an end result that was a little bit more liberal than you would have thought. Kansas, I would say the same thing. Texas is different. Florida is different. But they're all making their own decisions right now. And right now, the states control it. That's the vote of the people. Like Ronald Reagan, I believe in the exceptions. I am a person that believes. And frankly, I think it's important to believe in the exceptions. Some people, you have to follow your heart. Some people don't believe in that. But I believe in the exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. I think it's very important. Some people don't. Follow your heart. But you have to get elected also. And because that has to do with other things, you got to get elected. The problem they have is they're radical because they will take the life of a child in the eighth month, the ninth month, and even after birth. After birth, if you look at the former governor of Virginia, he was willing to do this. He said, we'll put the baby aside and we'll determine what we do with the baby, meaning we'll kill the baby. What happened is we brought it back to the states, and the country is now coming together on this issue. It's been a great thing.
Thank you. President Biden?
It's been a terrible thing, what you've done. The fact is that the vast majority of constitutional scholars supported Roe when it was decided. Supported Roe. And that was, that's this idea that they were all against it is just ridiculous. And this is the guy who says the state should be able to have it. We're in a state where in 6 weeks, you don't even know whether you're pregnant or not, but you cannot see a doctor and have your, and have him decide on what your circumstances are, whether you need help. The idea that states are able to do this is a little like saying we're going to turn civil rights back to the states, let each state have a different rule. Look, there's so many young women who have been, including a young woman who just was murdered, and he went to the funeral. The idea that she was murdered by an immigrant coming in. They talk about that. But here's the deal. There's a lot of young women are being raped by their in-laws, by their spouses, brothers and sisters, it's just ridiculous. And they can do nothing about it. And they try to arrest them when they cross state lines.
So that's President Biden and former President Trump. We're joined by Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Professor Goodwin, your assessment of this discussion of reproductive rights.
Well, what it exposes is just the chaos that we're in the United States in the wake of the Supreme Court dismantling Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which protected a woman's right to be able to terminate a pregnancy. And at that time, there was no need to lean into exceptions in cases of rape, in cases of incest, or in cases where a woman might die. But that's where we are, including before the Supreme Court just yesterday with its EMTALA decision, which was not full, but rather something that was technical. You see Donald Trump pivoting at the end, noting that this is an election season, So he has modified his position as sending basically a signal to others in his party not to go too hardline. That is to say that Americans support reproductive freedom. Americans want access to contraception. Americans want access to being able to terminate a pregnancy. Americans have heard stories after the Dobbs decision about women bleeding out, about girls having to flee one state to another in order to terminate a pregnancy, including a 10-year-old. Americans now know that there are girls going into elementary school and middle school now as mothers after the Dobbs decision. Americans have heard stories about women in Texas, in Tennessee, who wanted their pregnancies but found that they were gestating pregnancies where there was no fetal development or fetal development, but fetuses with no brains, fetuses with no skulls, gestating deceased fetuses, and in states where those pregnancies could not be terminated. Americans have heard about Idaho, where doctors have had to put pregnant women on helicopters in order to get them out of the state in urgent situations such that their lives could be spared. Now, that's the result of what Donald Trump has boasted about. And as he was running for president, he said he wanted to punish women who wanted to have abortions. What we heard last night is that he's talked about exceptions and that that's important to him. On the other hand, what we've heard consistently from the Biden administration is that Roe v. Wade should be codified and that that's something that Joe Biden would support. There's legislation in Congress to do that. There are a couple of different bills. The strongest, the one that's received the strongest support is the Women's Health Protection Act, and that's one that he has said that his administration would support. He has also supported that the EMTALA, Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, as applying to these urgent health situations that pregnant women find themselves in. That's what's been debated before the Supreme Court in a matter of a technicality. The Supreme Court ruled just yesterday that this is a question that should go back to the states, and as such, the Supreme Court did not dismantle the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. The Biden administration said that for patients that are struggling through their pregnancies, this federal law should apply. And indeed, it should, because federal law always preempts and trumps state law. But in Idaho, lawmakers there have said that their abortion ban is broad enough to cover EMTALA. That is to say that their state law should deny pregnant people who are in crisis situations that their abortion law would not allow them to be spared.
Professor Goodwin, could you respond to President Trump talking about those who are pro-abortion wanting to kill newborn babies, but also President Biden then talking about you've got to be able to have a response to immigrants raping women and women being raped by their sisters?
Well, the first is that there is this Republican talking point, which is not new. So it's something that he's picked up on. This was starting before his administration, this kind of messaging. And this messaging is that abortions are dangerous. Abortions kill the people that have abortions. We know that that is not true. You're 14 times more likely to die carrying a pregnancy to term than by having an abortion. The Supreme Court acknowledged that in 2016 in the case Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt. But on this point about abortion after birth, it's been a narrative that's been pushed by hardliners. It does not exist. Someone killing a baby after that baby is born, that would be prosecuted. We have no examples of that whatsoever. And of course, if we did, we would all know about it. It would be promoted by Republicans. We would know the name of the case. We would know the name of the doctors. We would know the name of the individual who sought that abortion after birth. It is not true. But what it does expose is also this loose, baked way in which science and health ends up getting distorted. And Americans have swallowed those sound bites. And so it's really important that we're clear that there is no such thing as abortion after birth. There is birth. And if a child is born and then murdered by someone, prosecutors then step in. On the other hand, what we heard from President Biden about individuals being raped, including being raped by relatives. Well, incest does exist. People can be raped and harmed by loved ones, by a brother, a father, an uncle. There are cases of that. There are tragedies associated with that. Right after the Dobbs decision, we heard about a little girl leaving Ohio to get to Indiana in order to terminate a pregnancy that was not by a relative, but a close family friend. President Biden's messaging did get distracted, and that is distinct from what has been his very firm position of his administration and the messaging of his administration to use everything within their administrative powers in order to protect reproductive health rights and justice for all people. Last night, the messaging got a bit garbled.
Michelle Goodwin, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, author of Policing the Womb. When we come back, we're going to look at immigration and foreign policy in this first presidential debate. Stay with us.
I wear this crown of thorns upon my liar's chair, full of broken thoughts I cannot repair. Beneath the stains of time, the feelings disappear. You are someone else. I am still right here. What have I become?
Covered by Johnny Cash. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The first 2024 presidential debate between President Biden and former President Trump held Thursday night, marking the first time a sitting president debated a former one. One of the major issues was abortion. We're going to start with President Trump. Was it immigration? Sorry. We're going to start with President Trump.
I didn't have legislation. I said, close the border. We had the safest border in history. In that final couple of months of my presidency, we had, according to Border Patrol, who is great, and by the way, who endorsed me for president, but I won't say that, but they endorsed me for president. Brandon, just speak to him. But look, we had the safest border in history. Now we have the worst border in history. There's never been anything like it. And people are dying all over the place, including the people that are coming up in caravans.
Thank you, President Trump. President Biden?
The only terrorist who's done anything crossing the border is one who came along and killed three, under his administration, killed an Al-Qaeda person, come in and his administration, killed three American soldiers. That's the only terrorist that's there. I'm not saying that no terrorist ever got through, but the idea they're emptying their prisons, we're welcoming these people, that's simply not true. There's no data to support what he said. Once again, he's exaggerating, he's lying.
For more, we're joined by Silke Shah, Executive Director of Detention Watch Network, author of the new book, Unbuild Walls, Why Immigrant Justice Needs Abolition. Her new piece for The Nation, headlined with, "As Immigration Policy Biden Capitulates to the Right's Racist Agenda." She's joining us from Washington State. Silke, if you can respond to both Trump and Biden talking about immigration last night.
Yes. I think it was a really, really rough night for those who are fighting for immigrant rights, for immigrant justice. Trump repeatedly was stoking a moral panic on immigration, and Biden had very little in response. And it was really terrifying to see. I mean, Trump at some point even, you know, he was critiquing the Clinton administration for using the term super predators, or in reflection on the black youth and black communities in the 90s. But repeatedly, Trump called immigrants, you know, really horrible things, murderers and rapists, and constantly saying that across the world, people are emptying prisons and sending people to the U.S. and stoking a moral panic. And rather than, you know, responding with moral leadership, Biden just fell into the trap and was responding in ways and saying at some point even said that there should be a total ban at the border, that he was going to push a total ban, and then sort of corrected himself and said, a total initiative at the border. And so it was just entirely in every single way. Trump kept bringing back immigration as an issue and stoking this sort of moral panic, stoking a crime panic and pushing this. And Biden really had very little in response and instead sort of fell into the trap and kept reinforcing the idea that immigration is a public safety issue and that immigrants should be met with law enforcement at the border instead of aid, and not really debunking this idea that it's a public safety issue and showing some more moral leadership in some way.
And Trump's comments, every state is a border now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that was terrifying to hear. What we see across the country is that states are pushing anti-immigrant legislation. We saw this before years ago with Arizona passing SB 1070, the quote unquote, show me your papers law. And now we see it under Abbott in Texas with Operation Lone Star and other laws using the criminal legal system. I mean, the whole conversation kept tying back this idea that the criminal legal system should be used to target immigrants. And Trump saying every state is a border now is sort of signaling to all those states, some 20 states saying, you know, they should pass their own immigration laws that use the criminal legal system to target immigrants, detain, incarcerate, you know, have them have long sentences in prison before being deported. And that was what I was hearing being signaled with that.
And the false trope about immigrant crime rate and what it really is compared to the general population. Of course, you have Trump repeating this over and over, but then the inexplicable response to abortion that President Biden gave immediately talking about an immigrant raping a woman.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in so many ways, this politicians repeatedly use moral panics and crime panics to gain political points, to, you know, do everything they can to win elections. And this is what we're seeing again. This is what we've seen time and again, and especially what we saw in the 90s, where we saw the rise in mass incarceration. And it's remarkable because just a few years ago, we had millions of people on the streets calling to defund the police, really understanding the inherent racism of our criminal legal system, of mass incarceration, of racist policing, and millions of people on the streets calling for the end to mass deportations, an end to family separations that we see. And now we're at this place where both candidates are repeatedly using a moral panic and pushing more state power and systemic repression at the border and in communities across the country. ICE is planning to build new detention centers. It's really terrifying to see.
Well, Silky Shah, we want to thank you for being with us. It was also the lack of fact-checking by the moderators when this repeated trope of immigrants commit crimes, when the fact is in the general population, the crime rate is much higher than in the immigrant population. Silky Shah, Executive Director of the Detention Watch Network, author of Unbuild Walls, Why Immigrant Justice Needs Abolition. There's so much to get to. We're going to turn to foreign policy now. Just an excerpt of the debate on Gaza.
Number one, everyone from the United Nations Security Council straight through to the G7 to the Israelis and Netanyahu himself have endorsed the plan I put forward, which has three stages to it. And the first stage is trade the hostages for a ceasefire. Second phase is a ceasefire with additional conditions. The third phase is the end of the war. The only one who wants the war to continue is Hamas, number one. They're the only ones standing out. We're still pushing hard to get them to accept. In the meantime, what's happened? In Israel, we're finding that the only thing I've denied Israel was 2,000-pound bombs. They don't work very well in populated areas. They kill a lot of innocent people. We're providing Israel with all the weapons they need and when they need.
As far as Israel and Hamas, Israel's the one that wants to go. He said the only one who wants to keep going is Hamas. Actually, Israel is the one, and you should let him go and let him finish the job. He doesn't want to do it. He's become like a Palestinian, but they don't like him because he's a very bad Palestinian. He's a weak one.
President Trump and President Biden debating Gaza. Norman Solomon is still with us, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-founder of RootsAction.org. His most recent book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Your response?
These two candidates are extreme militarists, and one of them, Donald Trump, is a proponent and a expressor of fascistic politics. So that's where we are. In terms of Gaza, we have a president who has enabled and participated in mass murder and genocide, continuing to ship all sorts of weapons and ammunition to Israel while it slaughters civilians every single day, refuses to engage in diplomacy, and yet that wasn't being debated at all. They were arguing about how well they would assist Israel in suppressing the rights of Palestinians and killing them every day. So that's where we are. And I think one point, as we are very clear about the reality of these militarists who are willing to slaughter civilians every day, at the same time, we're facing now a fork in the road. If Donald Trump is elected president, then the left, progressives, even a lot of liberals, will be on the defensive for 4 years. The space to organize will be virtually disappearing, except to try to mitigate the damage that will be done by the administration. Under a Biden or Democratic administration, we have huge problems, terrible foreign policy. What we do have is more space to organize, so we're not just back on our heels. We can organize for real progressive change.
Chris Layman, your final thoughts as you watch this debate, stayed up through the night writing your piece for The Nation, D.C. bureau chief for The Nation magazine.
Well, you know, I would echo virtually everything your other guests have said. And I think Norman underlined a really important point, which is the urgent need to mobilize in a democratic way to change the Democratic, capital D, Democratic ticket. It's a constant refrain, and it's true among Biden supporters that, you know, the soul of the nation and the fate of our democracy are both on the ballot in this cycle. What's paradoxical, though, is we see it in the case of the Gaza war, which is vastly unpopular with the general public. There is a refusal to heed democratic voices within the Biden administration and within the larger Democratic Party. It's important to, you know, pan back a bit and remember that, you know, the reason Democrats nominated Joe Biden in 2020 was that Barack Obama basically went behind the scenes to persuade all of his other primary rivals to fold their hands and, you know, cut deals with Biden to make him the front runner. And that was at a moment when Bernie Sanders was leading in the polls and actually was well ahead of Trump in the polls. So this was a very deliberate decision taken by the party establishment in 2020. And we are, you know, it's like Groundhog Day. We're back in this situation where the Democrats have tried to galvanize mass support behind a candidate who's manifestly not up to the job, and there is a failure to just acknowledge, you know, what Americans saw and heard, you know, loud and clear last night.
And Derek Hamilton, founding director of Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School. You just have 20 seconds.
You know, what is lost and sad in the messaging from this debate is some of the unprecedented interventions that happened during the pandemic, as dramatic as that was, especially in contrast to the Great Recession, where we invested directly in the American people. We should be building upon that.
Derek Hamilton, Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School. Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation. We also want to thank Norman Solomon of the Institute for Public Accuracy, as well as Michelle Goodwin at Georgetown. And finally, Silke Shaw of Detention Watch and Dean Baker. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening. It's Director of Development. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.